baseball fans, and welcome to a very special edition of the Roster Rhetorical, the official MLB Daily podcast. First of all, it's our first episode of 2016, so that's pretty cool. And secondly, it is our special Hall of Fame edition of the show, where we're going to break down everything Hall of Fame related before the final ballot comes out this week. And with me, as usual, are my two sometimes wonderful, sometimes sarcastic co-hosts. First,
sometimes our sarcasm is wonderful.
Speaking of the sarcasm, my first co-host, Mike Bates. Mike, how are you?
I am good, Chris. How are you?
I'm good. I appreciated the sarcasm. That was lovely.
It wasn't sarcasm. That was
honesty. It sounded like sarcasm, so I'm just going to just paint it up to
sometimes our sarcasm is wonderful.
To each their own, I guess. And my second co-host, as always, Matt Goldman. Matt, what's going on?
Not too much. I can't complain.
Right. Well, when we planned this episode, we thought, we could just do an entire episode on the Hall of Fame. But we have some outstanding news to get to. Which one of you wants to intro this week? I'm going to pass the buck off to somebody else.
I can take it.
Don't go jump at once. All right,
yeah,
Matt.
Yeah, go for it, Matt.
All right, so I can't remember what day it was. Was it the last day of the year? Was it December
31st?
Yes,
yeah, it was the 31st.
That the news broke that Kenta Maeda was signing with the Dodgers, and slowly the details leaked out, and the first news that dropped was that it was for an 8-year guaranteed deal, which kind of, I think it shocked everyone. I know I wasn't expecting an 8-year deal, and then the later news, which was even more shocking than how long the Dodgers signed him up for, was that they've signed perhaps, what could be one of the best contracts, I don't want to say of all time, just because that seems kind of outlandish, but it's an incredible deal for the Dodgers because, it's only $25 million guaranteed, I think is what Sherman reported the other day, but it's got incentives that can kick it up each year to an additional 10 to 12, maybe 10 to $13 million a year. So essentially the Dodgers are going to be the only way that the Dodgers will pay Maeda a lot of money is if he's worth it, which is, a deal that every team would love to be able to sign all of their players to.
Right, and I think that's the important part here, the fact that they didn't commit a ton of, AAV to a guy, but if he performs well, they're going to pay him for it. And the thing that stuck out to me, and Matt, I know you talked about this on Twitter, but I want to get Mike's thoughts on this, is how this impacts future free agents. And it's different because Maeda, was a foreign player. He came via the posting, process. And free agents are a little different. They have the CBA and everything like that. But how could this affect potential contracts down the road for free agents?
Well, I don't think it actually does a ton to major league players. I mean, if Japanese pitchers are going to wind up being so much cheaper than major league talent or current major leaguers, well, then I think, we'll see teams in Major League Baseball start looking even more to foreign markets than they already are. But this deal seems, at least to me, to be a real outlier. You think back to some of the prominent Japanese players who have come over in the past, whether that's Ichiro Suzuki, whether that's Daisuke, or whether that's,
Hisashi Iwakuma?
Yeah, or Yu Darvish. These are players who their teams ponied up a lot of money for them, but also got a generous contract and maybe not a fair open market contract. What's really interesting to me is that with the new posting system, every major league team the posting fee is capped at $20 million, and any major league team that bids that maximum is then free to openly bid or openly negotiate with Maeda, and then Maeda gets to make a decision. And if this is the best offer that he got, it really says a lot about how little confidence major league teams have in his ability to perform. At the same time, I think it's as Matt pointed out, there's almost no risk here to the Dodgers. Who we were speculating about whether or not they had any money to go after a free agent, and then in consecutive weeks they get Scott Kazmir and they get Kenta Maeda. And you know, it was really, I was really shocked that the Dodgers ponied up for him, but I think it's a great deal for them,
Mike,
in the short and long run.
Mike, do you think this gives any credence to our theory that we've talked about in the show a number of times, that the Dodgers maybe don't have endless trunks of money and can't do whatever they please, and they have to get creative in the way they sign free agents now?
I think that's possible. I mean, with so little guaranteed, you know, as long as he is having success, he'll be contributing to their success, and presumably their revenues will increase. But, you know, I think it's... I don't want to speculate any more than I already have, but, you know, the fact that this isn't a giant contract doesn't necessarily mean anything, because no team went huge, apparently, for Kenta Maeda. So, yeah.
Right. I think that's fair. But, Matt, going forward, obviously, you know, Maeda's performance is going to drive, you know, what he gets in terms of incentives. But from the Dodger perspective, they seem to have gotten the pitchers that they need to now fully have a rotation for next year and not be, you know, they now got a righty in Maeda. That doesn't mean they have to go full with five lefties. So what does this mean for the 2016 Dodgers and their rotation?
Well, I think, I mean, obviously the big takeaway is, you know, they've got a guy that, at least while it's not the major leagues, they have a guy that can throw over 200 innings. Since 2009, Maeda has thrown at least 175.2 innings in the JPL. So he's durable. Obviously, he'll have to get used to the five-man rotation and pitching on that schedule rather than the Japanese schedule. And, you know, it gives them another righty, like you said. And then something that I don't think I've seen really anyone talk about, it just because you usually don't talk about a guy getting traded after he just signs an eight-year contract, but I don't believe Maeda got, you know, any no-trade protection. At least it hasn't been reported yet. So, you know, one of the most interesting things about this deal is the fact that since there's so little guaranteed money, any team, you know, maybe outside of the A's, but, you know, any team that could be able to afford the incentive-based part of Maeda's deal could theoretically trade for him, because if he's not good, you're not going to pay him. But if he is good, then, you know, you wind up ponying up $13 million a year. So the Dodgers, you know, maybe after Julio Urias shows that he's ready for the major leagues and he's proved himself at the big league level for a couple months, maybe Maeda becomes trade bait. Obviously, Kazmir might opt out after next year, so they've got insurance in case he does with Maeda. So I really like this, as much as I hate to say it as a Giants fan, I really, really like this deal for the Dodgers, because as Mike said, there's, you know, seemingly no risk for them at all. And, you know, if he's not good, then so be it. They wasted $24 million, $25 million over 8 years, and that's, you know, something that almost any team can write off as, you know, a whoopsie.
I want to make sure that we add that we don't know at this time what the incentives are and what would trigger them, if they're innings or, you know, awards, strikeouts, whatever it may be. We don't know what they are yet, and that will definitely play a role in how this contract is, you know, valued or looked at.
I think you're probably right that it has to do with some awards and probably game starts.
I don't think it can be related to strikeouts. I want to say
or specifically innings, I don't believe.
Right. There was, in the new CBA, a lot of those incentive-based things that you would see in contracts, like home runs or RBIs, got taken out. So maybe innings or game started, I think, is something that it'll be.
Does he apply to the CBA, though? Yes?
Yes.
Well, okay. I mean, not right now, but once he signs his contract, yes. So
okay.
His contract has to stipulate.
It has to match
okay.
The standards.
I wasn't sure. Wanted clarification. But yeah, obviously, those are going to be the key toward evaluating how good of a deal this is for the Dodgers, because, I mean, let's just be honest. 8 years, $24 million is good, but if the incentives are very easily achievable, it's really not 8 years, $24 million. It really becomes the value of the average salary plus the incentives, and we're looking at a much bigger deal if these incentives are very easy for him to reach.
Right, but the over the next 8 years, salaries in Major League Baseball are presumably going to continue to increase. And at this point, a guy who's making $16 million, that's Mike Leake money. So if he's better than Mike Leake, this is a great deal for the Dodgers. They're going to get him for less than the market value.
I agree. I think.
And then,
go ahead.
But I think what's also really interesting is the Dodgers now have like 7 or 8 starting pitchers under contract, and it'll be interesting to see how they shake this out. Whether Alex Wood gets moved to the bullpen, given that he has some pretty pronounced platoon splits, or you know, Mike Bolsinger had a pretty decent run last year as kind of an out of nowhere starter for them. I got to imagine he's going to the bullpen. Brandon McCarthy will be back midseason. Hyunjin Ryu is supposedly going to be ready to start the season. Guys will get hurt. Guys will be ineffective, but it has the potential to be pretty crowded in the Dodgers' starting rotation this year.
Yeah, they're going to have a ton of options to choose from, and adding Maeda really gives them a bunch of higher-tiered options to go to, even after the debacle that was their offseason. So is that it on outstanding news? That was the only big thing we had to hit, right, guys?
Yeah, I think so. This thought just kind of popped into my head just now, which is if Maeda proves not to be good at all, at least out of a starting rotation, since he's not guaranteed any money, the Dodgers could theoretically put him in the bullpen and see if he can, you know, chuck it as a high-leverage reliever.
$3 million
Super
a
Bowl, but yeah, and you know, $4 million for a reliever, that's, you know, a going rate for a mid-level guy these days. You know, someone like Wade Davis or O'Day, they're getting $9-10 million a year now.
Right, so there's some flexibility there too for them because of the way they structured the deal. All right, so that's it on outstanding news, right?
I believe so.
Right, okay. So let's get into the meat and potatoes of this episode, and that is the fact that we're going to bigger more than we normally do ever on this show because we're talking about the Hall of Fame. And the date is Wednesday, correct, guys? Wednesday, we find out who made it and who didn't?
Supposedly. Yeah, the 6th, I believe.
Tomorrow's the 4th. So Wednesday.
Yep.
Yeah, so Wednesday the 6th, we will find out who made the Hall of Fame and who didn't. And we, myself, Matt, and Mike, prepared our own ballots. We prepared two types of ballots. One if we were constrained to the 10-person rule, and one if we could put as many people as we wanted on there. So guys, where do you want to start? Do we want to just give out our ballots?
Well, let's talk about like kind of our philosophy about
okay.
the Hall of Fame. Would you guys categorize yourself as big hall guys or small hall guys?
I am a small hall guy. But I'm not locked into a certain philosophy. If a player is worthy, and there's, you know, 7 or 8 players worthy, 10 players, 12 players worthy, I'll vote them all in. It's okay that, you know, 12 guys in a given pack could go into the Hall of Fame. That's okay with me. If you're a good player, you're a great player, you deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. I've never understood the, you know, we need to lessen the ballot and how many people can be voted. I've never understood that argument.
Yeah, I would agree with that I don't think I would lump myself into a small or big Hall of Fame group. It's just, you know, if they meet my objectives for, you know, being a great and being a Hall of Fame type guy, then I'm going to vote for him, and so be it. If I wind up having 16 guys on my ballot, there shouldn't be this arbitrary line of how many guys could theoretically get in altogether at 1 year.
And there could be years where I think there's 2 people that deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. You know, it could go back and forth. And I think there's obviously a fine line between the Hall of Very Good and the Hall of Fame. And I know that's very cliche to use, but I think it's very true in terms of the Baseball Hall of Fame. Mike, what about you?
Oh, I would echo your thoughts, but I'd say that I'm in general what would be considered a big Hall guy. I mean, just because. I think we're looking at a huge backlog of worthy candidates. I think it's important to realize that the league is almost twice the size of what it originally was when the American League and the National League merged. I think it's important to, you know, recognize that rosters are bigger and players are used differently, and with so many extra players. Filling so many different roles. I think it's entirely reasonable to have, a large number of Hall of Famers in the league at any given time, and a larger number of Hall of Famers, worthy Hall of Famers, on the ballot in any year.
So now that we've explained ourselves, should we just go into this player by player? Should we each do our own ballots? How do you guys want to do this?
Let's go player by player.
You want to go player by player? You want me to just narrow? You want me to moderate this forum?
Yeah, let's get going.
Okay, so player number one, we're doing this in alphabetical order. Garrett Anderson. Does anybody have him on their ballot?
No.
Okay.
Garrett Anderson was a very good player for a while, but generally overrated. But nobody's definition of a Hall of Famer.
Career 293 hitter, just to put it in the context for you. So Garrett Anderson is a no on for all of us. Jeff Bagwell.
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm a yes as well. And that, I guess, would... Well, no, maybe the next player will tell us where we all stand on the whole steroid issue.
So a couple of things about Bagwell. One is he's pretty clearly one of the top eight first basemen of all time. Especially if we're talking about just pure first baseman. In terms of his value, you know, he hit for power. He was a great base runner. He was a very good fielder. He had, you know, a ton of power and won an MVP award and a Rookie of the Year award. He defined a franchise for a long period. And, you know, he was excellent in every facet of the game. There are a bunch of voters, sadly, who, without any kind of publicly available evidence, are very free about talking about their suspicions that he may have used performance-enhancing drugs. We have no knowledge of that, and I think it's unfair for any voter to be using criteria like that they're not willing to put in the public record.
I completely agree with that sentiment. I really don't understand why it's the whole, I think he did it, so I'm not going to vote for him, and not really explain what makes you think he did it. And that's just kind of, it takes away from what the Hall of Fame is supposed to be about, and then puts the focus on the writers, and that's really not what this process should be about, but it's kind of turned into that, and that's one of the reasons why I hate the whole process to begin with. But the next player is definitely going to figure out wherever somebody's having an issue.
Sorry about that. I was getting some ice and some water.
Mike Bates is just trying to mess up the show. Just trying to take us down.
Well, if you hadn't drawn any attention to it, my audio
it sounded
could have
like
been
something
cut out for that period there, Chris.
It sounded like something exploded. So as the host, I was concerned about your safety.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was.
You've always been very concerned about my safety.
I believe the past episodes would show that I was concerned about your safety. But let's get back on track. This next player should definitely paint the picture where we all stand on steroids. Barry Bonds.
Well, I'm anti-steroids. I'm pro-Bonds. Steroids are bad. Bonds was a product of his time, and we don't know how many players used and didn't use in that era. And to me, omitting Bonds is turning your back on an entire era that he ran. I mean, he was just out of this world.
I'd use the word disingenuous to describe not leaving Bonds off of your ballot. It's just disingenuous to that period of baseball, whether you agreed with it or not. Matt, you in on Bonds? Yes, no?
I'm very in on Bonds.
That was a dumb question. You were
kidding, huh? But you know, even if you're anti steroids, it's been pretty chronicled of when Bonds began using, and if you cut off his career in '98, which I believe is the last year before he started using, he's very much a Hall of Fame player. And, you know, obviously, something that you guys have both said, you can't just cut out the steroid era from baseball history. You know, I think a lot of people have, or at least a lot of baseball writers, at least who said Bonds is not Hall of Fame level or material, have said something like, well, you know, I don't want to explain to my kid what Barry Bonds did, you know, that he cheated and then got into the Hall of Fame. And, you know, that's just one of the weirdest reasons to me. You know, you can explain to your kid that what he did was wrong, but you can also explain to him that he was one of the all-time talents that the sport has ever seen. So on multiple fronts, Bonds deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and a Hall of Fame without him is cheapening the history of the game.
All right. So I have a bit of an issue with what you said. And I think So I'm looking for Mike Bates to back me up on this, but I don't know if he will. So there's one part of your argument, and I agree with you. I have Bonds on my ballot. But there's one argument that I just cannot stand. And that's the, if you just cut off this period of his career and just look at before he's a Hall of Famer. And the reason why I don't like it is, let me give you an example. Let's take any other player. Let's take, since we said him before, Garrett Anderson. And you cut out 4 or 5 seasons of his career just because, and you can then just look at a narrow fraction of his career, and he's a Hall of Famer in that fraction. That's the same argument as taking years away from Bonds because he did steroids, and I think that is a slippery slope that could lead to certain people getting into the Hall that don't deserve it.
I agree with that thought, except for the fact that, in my opinion, Garrett Anderson was never a Hall of Famer. So, you know,
I was just using him as an example because he was one of the players that we left out.
The only reason that I use that for Bonds is because people focus on the steroid era, and that, you know, people would love to just wipe that out from baseball history. So if you would, if you're on that side that just does not want to talk about the steroid era ever, then let's not talk about it, and then let's just focus on Bonds before steroids when he was still a Hall of Fame player. So that's really the only reason why I brought that up.
I think
right, and we're not talking about a short period either. We're talking about 13 years of elite baseball in which he won how many MVPs? 3 MVPs.
I believe 3. Yeah.
Yeah. So and a ton of Gold Gloves, and at that point he had already hit 290 with a 966 OPS, a 164 OPS plus, and 411 homers and 445 stolen bases. If he'd retired right then, he would have gotten in no problem.
No, I'm not debating that. I know what the numbers say, but I just think it's very easy for somebody on the other side of the argument to flip that around and say, well, if you can take years off of Bonds, you can take years off of somebody else, and that person could be a Hall of Famer. I just think it's a weird argument.
Only if they had Hall of Fame production, like Matt was saying, for, again, 13 years.
Yeah, you know, we're not saying let's take, you know, the best 6 years of David Eckstein's career and then just pretend that he never played any other season. But you know, I do understand what where you're coming from.
But you can take, like, 8 or 9 years of a guy and cut out maybe 3 or 4 bad years that they had that may lean them away from being a Hall of Famer and skew it the other direction.
But that only helps you with the rate stat, or with the
cumulative
batting average, the on-base percentage, the slugging percentage. You know, it doesn't.
But those are barometers that some voters use.
But they also use hits and home runs and stolen bases and Gold Gloves and playoff appearances and all kinds of stuff.
I agree. I was just making a point. You don't have to, you know, gang up on me.
No, we're just pointing out that your point doesn't make sense.
Well, thank you. The people are gonna like that. All right, Roger Clemens.
Yes.
Everybody's in on Clemens.
Yeah, me too. You know what I think is really interesting? I'm looking at one of the guys that I think we all follow on Twitter, who's doing God's work, is Ryan Tibbs.
Yes.
Who's got a ballot tracker.
The tracker that I'm using for the show right now.
Yep. He's at not Mr. Tibbs on Twitter. And just to give him some credit. And so there have been 143 publicly available ballots as of tonight, according to his tracker. Bonds and Clemens each... Bonds has 71 votes, Clemens has 70. And just going through all of the voters who have submitted a ballot, only 3 of the 143 only voted for one of those guys. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, so what it seems to be is voters are viewing them as a package deal, and it's a barometer on how they feel about the era.
And let's just put it in the context that only 31.8% of ballots are known at the moment. So
right, but that's a pretty great.
There's a lot of pending votes out there.
Sure, but that's a really huge sample size.
I agree.
I mean, it's a sample size that, I think is a little skewed just because the people who released the ballots early tend to be some of the more thoughtful voters.
Now, with Bonds and Clemens, and we can look at this for other guys, but their 2015 percentage of public ballots was much higher than their percentage of non-public ballots. So there could be, come Wednesday, the ballots that we don't see until, the end, that percentage could skew them down. I mean, they're only...
Yeah, they'll absolutely go down.
And they're only at currently 49.7 and 49, respectively, for Bonds and Clemens. So that's on public ballots. So they are well shy of the mark. So it will be interesting to see what happens from now until Wednesday and how many more ballots we see. Jim Edmonds is next. No.
I am on the Jim Edmonds Hall of Fame train.
Really?
I am as well.
Really? Yes. Both of you? Wait, under the 10 cap or the no limit cap?
Under the 10 cap,
he makes it.
Under the 10 cap, he makes it. That's interesting. I don't have him as my 10 or my no limit cap. So I'm... You know what, guys? Sell me on this. Sell me on putting him on my list.
All right, well...
Go ahead, Matt. You start off.
If... Ignoring home run totals in that, just because I'm not the biggest fan of using 400 or 500 as a reason to let a guy in. From 1995 through 2005, he had every season he had an F4 above 4, except for the 1999 season in which he was hurt and only played 55 games. So for a very long stretch of time, Jim Edmonds was one of the league's best players. And his cumulative rate stats for the the old school stat fans out there, his slash line ended at 284, 376, 527. He had a WOBA of 385 and a career WRC plus of 132, which means for his entire career he was 32, or he was a better than league average hitter by 32%. And he racked up a cumulative F4 of 64.5, which which is a better total than a lot of guys that are already in the hall. He had a career ISO of 243, great strikeout and walk rates, pretty much his entire career. And so he's one of those guys that seems to have just been lost in the long stream of backlogged candidates that Bates was talking about earlier. And for whatever reason, he does not get the love that I think he very rightfully deserves.
Well, I think he gets lost because of the era he played in. Obviously the late 90s and early 2000s were the performance-enhancing drug era. There were a ton of sluggers around. A lot of those behemoths that were putting up huge numbers, they sized themselves out of premium defensive positions. But somebody like Edmonds, he was an elite fielder in a premium defensive position in center field. He was, extremely capable. I think from 95 to 2005, so that's an 11-year stretch, he's probably the second-best center fielder in baseball next to Griffey. I think he is... he was the whole package, except for stealing bases. If we're just going with, we could say for that 11-year stretch, he had a .293 batting average, he had a .388 OPS, he had a .554 slugging percentage while winning 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 Gold Gloves in 11 years. He didn't get the MVP recognition that he probably should have. But he was just an incredibly, amazingly consistent performer who did fantastic work while playing a really difficult position and playing it well.
You know what? You've convinced me to bump somebody off the 10 and put Edmonds in.
And for me, I have to say, Edmonds is on... is on my 10 bubble.
Yeah,
like
that's where I have
probably,
him.
He'd probably be 9 or 10 for me, or 11 or 12. But the fact that I think he's really getting boned by, pardon me, that he's that getting really just... screwed by the 10 vote limit and by people just truly not understanding how great he was, you know, I would strategically vote for him to increase the chances that he stays on the ballot longer. But I think as we look at the ballot tracker, he's somebody who's in very serious danger of getting Lou Whitaker'd, where he just is gone after one ballot, and because people just don't recognize how good he was.
That's the concern. I mean, he's only at 2.8% right now. What does he need? He needs 5, right, to stay on the ballot?
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to need to get a lot of votes quickly.
He's not going to get them, and that's sad.
All right, I'm going to skip the next person because it's Nomar Garcia-Parra, and I know none of us voted for him.
Yeah, but Nomar was so good.
We were talking about this before the show.
He was so amazing. Like, for the first 6 years of his career, like, he was just out of this world, and then he hurt his wrist, and he just never was the same. And, boy, you know, if you'd told me in, you know, August of 2000 that Nomar Garcia-Parra wasn't going to be a Hall of Famer, I would have laughed in your face.
Ken Griffey Jr. is on all of our lists, I know, so we don't really have to talk about him. I think it's obvious.
Yeah, he was so good.
I think it's
so
obvious.
Good.
Right now, out of public ballots, 100%. I don't think he's going to get that, but he could break the record. He could.
That's really the only interesting thing to follow about Griffey at this point is, you know, he's obviously getting in, and the question is, will he be the first 100% guy? And I don't think so, just because, you know, there are guys that didn't vote for Tony Gwynn, so I assume one of those guys will also not vote for Ken Griffey Jr. But he could be close.
It's, it's Seaver's record, right? That would be disappointing.
I believe so.
Yeah, I think it's Seaver. As a Met fan, I should know this. I am pretty sure it's Seaver.
I think it's really the one thing I would point out that's interesting about Griffey is that Griffey is being used by a certain segment of the voting block or voting populace as a clean candidate
right.
in comparison to Bonds and Clemens. And he probably was, but I just would point out that none of us have any idea what players from that era used and what players didn't. And I wouldn't put it past any particular player to have used performance-enhancing drugs or have stayed away from them. You know, there's just so much we can't know.
So did either of you see the Ricky Henderson quote about steroids the other day?
I did not.
No.
I can't remember where it was, but... I believe this, you know, I could be, you know, with the internet these days, you can't really be 100% sure what's legit and what's not, but someone asked him about steroids, and he said something to the effect of, they hid those from me, and I was thinking, man, you know, Ricky on steroids would have been great, hell yeah, I would have taken them, which I thought was a funny answer from a guy, is already a Hall of Fame talent.
Yeah, that is rather interesting. But we're seeing the referendum.
And he would have been around them. I mean, I did a look a few years back where I looked at people in the Hall of Fame who played with steroid users, and it's virtually every single person who's appeared on a ballot over the last 5 years. Nolan Ryan played with a ton of them. Ricky Henderson, just because he played everywhere, played with a ton of them. We can't assume these guys didn't use while other players did, or we can't simply assume they're clean. You know, some of them probably did try.
We weren't there. We don't know is the way I describe it to people. It's you are not in the room, so you don't know.
The first guy who got popped, and I think Craig Calcaterra said this the other day, the first guy who got suspended for steroid use was Nafy Perez.
Good old Nafy.
Nafy. This one I think is going to cause a little debate. Trevor Hoffman. I have him in as my 10.
I do not have him as a 10, but I have him in the no-limit ballot that we are going with.
Mike?
I have him in the 10 just barely.
Yeah, I have him as 10.
Yeah, he would be probably nine. Be 9 for me, yeah. With Edmonds as 10.
Yeah, see, for me, and I know that there's, you know, debate about what a closer's worth and, you know, starting pitching and closing, but him and Mariano Rivera transformed what a closer was about, and it's hard for me to vote for a lot of closers, but I think Hoffman and Rivera would be the two that I would, you know, make an exception for, and you know, you'd call me a homer for it just because, you know, I just love Trevor Hoffman, but I had to put him on the list.
I don't know that he changed. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna. I really dislike, and you know, this is not a personal attack on Chris, but I really dislike the argument that a lot of people will go with who just don't vote for closers in general, which is that relievers or closers in general don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, which I just really dislike because, I mean, you know, they're one of the 25 guys on the roster. They contribute greatly to an overall team success, depending on how good they are. And Hoffman, just over his career, was a great reliever. And, you know, it's almost like when people say we just shouldn't let anyone in who played in the steroid era. It's almost like these writers are trying to just ignore the fact that this position exists and are doing their damnedest to keep relievers out of the Hall.
I agree. And maybe it was unfair of me to say that, you know, I would exclude all closers. But really, there's just a certain standard that a reliever or a closer has to meet for me, just me personally, and it takes a lot to get there, and that's why Hoffman and Rivera would be the two, at least, that I can think of offhand that would do that right away on a first time, right away basis, first ballot. This next one, I see people vote for this guy, and I don't understand, and that's Jeff Kent.
Ooh, he is on my ballot.
Which one?
The 10.
Really? You put him on the 10?
What did you leave out on the 10?
Well, I guess we'll get there one time.
I think we will. Chris. If you left off... Oh, man.
Well, okay, so here's my reasoning for Kent. You know, he's kind of a bubble guy to me, but if we're looking at the, you know, the greats, you know, the second baseman, he kind of falls into the Jim Edmonds camp to me, almost, not on the same level of, you know, how good he was, but in that he seems to be another guy from that era that just gets left behind. You know, he compares pretty favorably to Ryne Sandberg, who is a Hall of Fame second baseman, and, you know, he rates better than Sandberg in a few areas. Sandberg was a much better defensive second baseman. Kent was, I don't want to say atrocious, but he was just barely better than league average throughout his entire career. He had a couple seasons that were really awful. But 377 homers, career line of 290, 356, 500, 367 WOBA, 123 WRC+, and his MVP award is a little tough to really write home
take
about.
Seriously,
yeah, just because of, you know, how much he at least growing up in San Francisco, it was really given to him to spurn Bonds,
right?
Not that, you know, Kent didn't,
but it was a fantastic season.
Right, he had a great season. There's no arguing against that, but, you know, looking back at history, that should be Bonds' award. But if you're having a conversation about the greatest second baseman of all time, at least offensively, I think Kent would be in that conversation. So that is why he would get my vote.
Yeah, for me, he's a bubble guy too, and I would vote for him on an extended ballot. Like, if it was just an up and down vote, I think he's a deserving Hall of Famer. I just think that there are 10 better guys to get on this list. So, yeah, he falls short of my 10, but he really was a fantastic player for a long time. And you know, he lasted until he was 40, which you don't get from second baseman very often. And he stayed at the position.
True.
Yeah.
Alright, we gotta pick up the pace here, guys. We're slacking. We're taking too long with these discussions. I didn't expect this much. I really didn't. Our next player is Edgar Martinez.
Yes.
Yes.
I have him on my 10 as well.
I mean, DH has been around since 1972. We know that you know, guys that guys who DH don't contribute defensively, but Martinez was just so good on offense that I think he transcends that.
That's my argument. You can put a DH in, but he has to be so much better as a hitter than, you know, his peers, and I think Martinez was, and really was what you want as a DH, and that's why I have him on my 10. Matt, anything else you want to add to that?
I think you guys nailed it. I mean, you know, to punish him for playing a position that, you know, the American League created is just such a silly reason to keep a guy out of the Hall of Fame. If he'd played defense more often, even if he'd been terrible at it, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. I think he'd be in the Hall of Fame by now. If he'd just been a crappy first baseman or a crappy third baseman, a lot of people would look at him differently. But to have a Hall of Fame without Edgar Martinez is kind of just like ignoring another facet of the game, which is the DH.
Fred McGriff, no for me.
No, just not enough.
Sorry, Fred.
Yeah, Fred, we apologize.
Not dominant enough, not good enough for long enough. He was a very good player.
Mark McGwire, no for me.
Also no.
Yes,
on an extended?
But on the extended ballot. You know, if I was voting well, this is his last year, so if I was voting strategically, I would leave him off because he's got no chance. You know, I grew up with Mark McGwire. I became a baseball fan like the year before McGwire came into his own in 1987, and he was, you know, one of the first superstars that I followed, and he was just transcendently powerful at first base. And obviously we know that a lot of that was the chemicals that we don't know that it was the chemicals he put in his body, but we know that he was putting chemicals in his body to make himself bigger and stronger and stay on the field longer. But he was like, nobody had his power in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, I there was a time where he was baseball and was absolutely dominant. And I think that counts for something. To me, at least.
Fair enough. You get an extended ballot for a reason, Mike. You can put whoever you could write yourself in on the list if you want.
No, I haven't played 10 years in the majors.
Mike Mussina.
Yes.
So he's on my extended ballot.
He's on my 10.
I'm trying to.
Oh, you know what?
Find some.
I mistakenly left him off my 10 ballot. Oh, I gotta say goodbye to.
Yeah, I think Hoffman's gonna have to go off for me. So I can put Mussina in as 10. Now that I'm looking at this, because I did the same thing, Mike. I forgot about Mussina.
If I was doing this strategically, for me, Griffey would
probably
go off because he's going to get in.
But what if you're the one guy though that doesn't vote for?
I don't care. He's in the Hall of Fame. Whereas, and listen. Griffey's great. He's not the greatest player in baseball history.
This
so,
is why
know,
you need an extended ballot. So writers don't do this.
But making sure that guys like Mussina, guys like Hoffman, guys like Edgar, guys like Hoffman, Billy Wagner, Jim Edmonds can stay on the ballot longer. I'll absolutely make that trade-off when it doesn't actually hurt Griffey at all.
Yeah, I have to find. I think Hoffman's gonna have to go to my extended ballot, and I gotta put Mussina in on my 10 ballot.
Yeah, and if you look at the similarity scores, part of Baseball Reference, and you look at them for Mike Mussina, he compares favorably to Marichal, who's a Hall of Famer, Palmer, who's a Hall of Famer, and Hubble, also, you know, one of the earlier Hall of Fame members, pitched his entire career in the AL East during the height of the steroid era. Still wound up with a better than average ERA plus. It was at 123 at the end of his career. 270 wins compared to 153 losses. He always had, not dominating strikeout numbers, but a career walk rate per nine of just 2, career homer per nine under 1, And he was doing that against some of the most prolific sluggers that the game has ever seen. And, you know, again, to pitch in the AL East the entirety of your career is just, it's insane. You know, 3,562 innings. He showed up every year, 200-inning guy for, you know, almost from 1995 to the end of his career. He's definitely one of those guys that deserves it.
You know, I think it's... his candidacy to me reminds me a little bit of Blylevin's candidacy, because Blylevin was never the best pitcher in the league, and it was never really seen as the best pitcher in his league. But he was seen as a very good pitcher, and he pitched for a long time and was consistently excellent. And I think Mussina's got the same thing going for him, where he was just consistently year in and year out a very, very, very good pitcher.
Mike Piazza.
Yes.
Yes, I think.
He falls into the same Bagwell trap.
Wrongly, but yes.
But he's so good. I mean,
greatest hitting catcher ever.
Greatest hitting catcher ever.
Best. Until Buster Posey retires.
All right, you just... Okay, look, that's not an argument you want to start.
You know, and you know, I don't know that we really... Like, he wasn't a good thrower behind the plate, but I think we don't
He was
really
an okay
know.
Thrower.
I don't think we really know about his defensive skills, because we didn't have the ability to look at pitch framing back then. So, you know, I'm willing to give him a discount on the defense, but, you know, the greatest hitting catcher of all time belongs in.
He belonged in 3 years ago, but
we'll get there.
I'll just... pipe down. Tim Raines.
Yes.
He's on my 10.
Yep. Now, I'm looking at the DEF rate, or the DEF rating on Fangraphs, and maybe Mike, you can back this up or shoot it down. They have him as a horrible, horrible, horrible defensive outfielder.
He was not a good defender from my recollection and understanding from that time. Yeah, he was no better than an average corner outfielder.
He's got a career defensive rating of minus 109.6.
Yeah, I don't know how much we're gonna trust those numbers.
Right, and that's yeah, of course.
But I do, you know, I don't think his defense helps his case. But I mean, for Raines, it's just all about his on-base percentage and his abilities as a base runner and just being a completely dynamic leadoff hitter for the Expos. And again, if we're talking about somebody who, you know, defined an organization, there is no more Expo than Tim Raines.
Kurt?
Would he be the first guy to go in as an Expo?
Gary Carter.
No, Gary Carter.
Gary Carter, okay.
And Andre Dawson.
And Andre Dawson.
Oh, okay.
I just know Carter went in as an Expo, that's all. That's my recollection. Kurt Schilling. Yes, everybody?
He's on my extended ballot.
Really? He's on my 10.
He'd be on my 10, too. He'd be somebody I would consider dropping for strategic reasons. But
that's the only reason why I didn't have him, was, you know, strategery.
Oh, the strategery.
Yeah.
He's got a great case for the regular season and his postseason antics. Put him over the top for me.
Gary Sheffield is a no for everybody.
He's one of those guys who's really borderline for me. If I had an infinite ballot, I'd probably put him on it, but he'd be very near the bottom of it. Like, I wouldn't stump for him.
He needs 11 votes to stay above 5%.
His defense was so bad.
Look at him. Is Matt changing his vote?
I want to, just because of how great of an offensive player he was. And then looking at his defensive numbers, we're not really sure how great they are. The advances of StatCast are really going to help revolutionize the way we look at defensive players.
I can tell you,
he was awful, according to FanGraphs.
He was atrocious.
He was three times as worse throughout his career than Tim Raines was.
Especially in the infield, actually. You know, there were rumors that he was airmailing throws to get out of Milwaukee in the early part of his career. I don't know if that's true, but he was not a good infielder, and he was not a good outfielder either. He was really a man who the DH was born for, and he just didn't get to use it really for much of his career.
Yeah, and for the sparing number of years that defensive runs saved was a thing while Sheffield played, he in his career cost various teams from 2003 to 2009. He was responsible for a loss of, I want to say, if I'm adding correctly, negative 35 runs.
Wow.
Which is a full season of Pablo and Hanley last year.
He hit his 500th home run as a Met. That's all I care about.
So he's in the hall for you.
That's it. He's in. That's all it takes. Lee Smith in his second to last year on the ballot. No,
I did originally, and then in the process of during the process of this show, I took him off.
I don't think he was ever as good as his record save total would have you indicate. He was just a good reliever for a lot of years, and to me, just was never as dominant as some of the other closers of his era were.
He's a Hall of very good.
Right, I think that's a distinction that we make sometimes. Sammy Sosa.
Yes.
He's on my extended ballot.
Extended ballot.
My extended ballot,
he's on
too.
Mine as well. I just think...
He there was a time where he just kind of owned baseball.
Right.
And was everywhere. And was exceptional. You know, and we know now that there were some things going on, and you know, that he was on some kind of PEDs, or at least the widely suspected of being on PEDs, but boy, he was just dynamic.
Alan Trammell on his last year of the ballot.
Yes.
Go
ahead.
So he's on my extended ballot just because I can't find a spot for him.
I would put him in my top 10.
That's because you're just
going to
take Griffey and all those people out.
No. I would put him in my top 10 for overall value. I would take him out strategically because there's no way that Alan Trammell is getting into the Hall of Fame this year, which is a shame. He is absolutely worthy of it, and another Detroit Tiger gets screwed in this process. But, he belongs, but he won't get in, so I'd rather give somebody a chance who's... on that bubble.
Billy Wagner.
Yes, very much so.
And your 10 or extended?
He's in my extended just because I couldn't find room for him, but
I don't know how to feel on him. I'm not sure. I want to put him on my extended.
If you're going to vote for Hoffman, I think you have to vote for Wagner because he was more dominant. Now he doesn't have the save totals that Hoffman does, but Wagner in his career had an 11.92 K per 9, walk rate of 2.99, homer per 9 of 0.82, career ERA of 2.31, and a FIP of 2.73. And then my favorite Billy Wagner fact is the fact, or I don't didn't mean to say fact twice in a row, but he was not born left-handed. He broke his arm, I believe, twice, his right arm. I believe he was told that if he hurt it again, they might have to just get rid of his arm and they might have to amputate it. And so he taught himself how to throw left-handed.
Wow. That is a great story.
Mike, where do you
have him? He would be on my extended as well. He's totally worthy of being in the Hall of Fame, I think. And as Matt said, just an absolutely dominant left-handed reliever. And one I would have no qualms putting in, but there are too many people above him to put him on my top 10.
And the last person, Larry Walker.
Yes.
No for me.
Ooh.
He's no at all? He'd be on my extended as well, and depending on who I bump off, I might include him. But I was on the bubble about him for a very long time. If I had an infinite ballot, he would absolutely be on it. Just an elite defender in right field, and a very good hitter, even accounting for the Coors thing.
Yeah, I used to be against him because of the Coors thing, and then in the past couple years, kind of in the same way that I don't think it's fair to penalize Edgar Martinez for being a DH or Wagner or Hoffman for being a reliever. It's not fair to penalize a guy because he played in Colorado. You know, being in Colorado doesn't magically make you an elite hitter. You know, obviously it boosts your ability, you know, as we've seen time and time again. But Larry Walker was not made into a Hall of Fame caliber player just because he moved to Colorado for a significant portion of his career.
Fair enough. I put him on the extended ballot. He made the final list for me.
Is he in your top 10, Matt?
No, he is a strategery guy, just because I don't think he's got a real shot at making it this year either. I put other guys on that I think deserve to, you know, stay on our fake ballots.
So here's how I want to close the show, because we make these ballots and this is who we want in the Hall of Fame or we think should get in the Hall of Fame. But then there's the question of who's actually going to get in this year.
Yeah.
So who wants to go first by explaining who they think is going to make it on Wednesday?
I'll go first.
Okay, go ahead.
Go for it.
I think Griffey obviously is a lock, and then I think he will be joined by two fellows, which will be Bagwell and who's the other guy?
Piazza?
Well, actually, you know what? I'm going to go. He's going to be joined by three. So my class of 2016 will be, yes, Bagwell, Griffey, Edgar Martinez, and Mike Piazza.
Edgar?
You have Edgar?
Really?
Really?
I don't know.
49.
Edgar's at less than 50% at the moment.
On the public ballots?
He needs 87% of the remaining ballots to get in.
Okay, you know what? I take it back. I guess I got trigger happy with the number of extra votes he's gained this year. So I'll bring it back to the three guys: Bagwell, Piazza, and Griffey.
Mike,
I'm thinking it's just two. I think it's going to be Griffey and Piazza. You know, I think Piazza's at this point, he's polling at 87.4%. I think he's going to be, I think he's going to get enough of the rest of the ballots to squeak by. I really hope he does, because, you know, we adding to this backlog only makes life more difficult. I don't have a lot of faith that Jeff Bagwell and Tim Raines, who are both currently polling above 80%, are going to be able to hold that. I think once these extra ballots come in, and by Wednesday, we'll find out that they probably slip down to close to 70%, which is a bummer. But that represents a pretty big gain for both of them and bodes well for them, and especially for Raines in 2017.
So I have two as well, and it's Griffey and Piazza. But if you had to make me pick a third, if I think a third was going to get in, I think Raines over Bagwell.
Maybe.
I just think people are going to, although if people aren't going to vote for Bagwell, they wouldn't vote for Piazza, but I think Raines could be the third if there would be a third. But I think we're only going to see two people go in the Hall this year. And that's sad, honestly. I really think there's a lot of good players out here that should get in.
Well, clearly, because looking at my list, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I have 15.
So I have 16.
Yeah, I mean, my list is extensive, and I added because you guys convinced me to, but I'm at 15. So
no, I'm sorry, I'm at 18.
So 18, and you only think two are going to get in. I have 15, and I only think two are going to get in. Matt is the optimistic one out of the three of us, and he has, you have three, right?
Yeah, Bagwell, who's at 81.8% right now, Piazza, who's at 87.4% right now, and then Griffey, who's 100%.
So that is a reflection of what the voter pool is looking like right now and what potentially could happen, because a lot of votes are still out there, and it could shift it in one way or another. We'll find out on Wednesday. Mike, tell the lovely people where they can find the show.
Well, the lovely people can find us at on iTunes. They can find us, if they don't have an iPhone, they can find us wherever they get their podcasts. For Android, or if you're like me for Windows phones, if you don't like listening over your phone, if you don't have a commute, maybe just go to any article at MLB Daily Dish where we all write, and down at the bottom is a player that can start this podcast or any future podcasts that you might want to listen to.
And Matt, I know we had some Twitter questions, but what I'm going to tell you is tell the lovely people where they can send their Twitter questions, because I think what we want to do is next week I want to do just a Twitter question episode if no other news breaks.
Right. And we will be sending out this some tweets to ask for your questions throughout the week. But if you think of one and we have not reached out to you lovely people for some questions, you can tweet us at Chris R. Schubert, Mike Bates, SBN, myself at The Original Bull, or the headquarter Twitter account, which is at HQ. MLB Daily Dish.
Yep. Yeah, just tweet us at one of those four places with your question, and let us
know
that it's for the podcast.
And you know what? The people who aren't lovely, they can find us at those places too.
Oh, that's right, because I said for the lovely people. I see what you did there, Mike. I appreciate you making that.
I'm feeling generous today.
Okay, well, you know what? If you're feeling generous, I'll just go along with it. But yeah, send us your questions. We will get through as many of them as we can. We always like debating things, as you could tell by this week. So send us everything you got. We'll get to it. And if any other news happens, we'll obviously reconvene and talk about that. So, guys, it's been a blast. This was a fun episode. I was excited about this last week, and this was as fun as I thought it was going to be.
Good.
Did you guys feel the same? I was looking for some feedback there.
I mean, you guys are all right.
You guys are all right. All right. Well, that's...
No, this was good. I always love talking about the Hall of Fame. You know, as I wrote earlier this week, like, I've tried to quit the Hall of Fame, and I just can't do it. I still care about it. I still think it's important. I still think it's a debate worth having every year, and I'm glad that we took a moment to appreciate it.
Sucks you back in every time, right?
Yep.
All right, guys, that's going to do it for us this week. We will see you next week for another episode.